This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I have a wonderful story from the Harlem Renaissance for you by Ms. Nella Larson. Give you a chance to get settled, and I'll be right back here at KTO 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Hello, this is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here tonight with Nella Larson, an author from the Harlem Renaissance. The title of this story is called The Wrong Man. The room blazed with color. It seemed that the gorgeous things which the women were wearing had for this once managed to subdue the strident tones of the inevitable black and white of the men's costumes. Tonight they lent just enough a preciseness to add interest to the righteously hued scene. The place was crowded, but cool, for a gentle breeze blew from the sound through the large open windows and doors, now and then stirring some group of flowers. Julia Romley, in spite of the smoke-colored chiffon gown ordered specially for the occasion, which she was wearing, seemed even more flamingly clad than the rest. The pale and definite gray but increased the flaring mop of her hair. Scarlet, a poet had called it. The satiny texture of her skin seemed also to reflect in her cheeks a cozy tinge of that red mass. Julia, however, was not happy tonight. A close observer would have said that she was actively disturbed. Faint abstraction, trite remarks nervously offered, and uncontrolled restlessness marred her customary perfect composure. Her dreamy gray eyes stole frequently in the direction of Myra Redmond's party. Myra always had a lion in tow, but why that particular man? She shook a little as she wondered. Suddenly the orchestra blared into something wild and impressionistic with a primitive staccato understrain of jazz. The buzz of conversation died, strangled by the savage strains of the music. The crowd stirred, broke, coalesced into twos, and became a whirling mass. A partner claimed Julia, and they became part of the swaying mob. "Some show what?" George Hill's drawling voice was saying, while he secretly wondered what had got into Julia. She was so quiet, not like herself at all. Julia let her eyes wander over the moving crowd. Young men, old men, young women, older women, slim girls, fat women, thin men, stout men glided by. The old nursery rhyme came into her head. She repeated it to George in a sing-song tone. Rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief. George nodded. Yes, that's it. Everybody's here and a few more. And look, look, there's the Indian chief. Wonder who he is. He certainly looks the part. Julia didn't look. She knew what she would see. A tall, thin man, his lean face yellowed and hardened as if by years in the tropics. A man, perhaps a bit unused to scenes of this kind. purposely a little aloof and, one suspected, more than a little contemptuous. She felt a flash of resentful anger against Myra. Why was she always carting about impossible people? It was disgusting. It was worse. It was dangerous. Certainly, it was about to become dangerous to her, Julia Rombley, erstwhile. She let the thought die unfinished. It was too unpleasant. She had been so happy, so secure, and now this. Ralph Tyler, risen from the past to shatter the happiness which she had grasped for herself. Must she all begin all over again? She made a hasty review of her life since San Francisco days. Chicago and the art school where she had studied interior decorating with the money that Ralph Tyler had given her. New York, her studio and success. Boston and marriage to Jim Romley. And now this envied gay life in one of Long Island's most exclusive sets. Yes, life had been good to her at last, better than she had ever dreamed. Was she about to lose everything? Love, wealth, and position? She shivered. Cold? Again, George's drawling voice dragging her back to the uncertain present. No, not cold. Just someone walking over my grave, she answered laughingly. I'm rotten company tonight, George. I'm sorry. I'll do better. It's the crowd, I guess. Her husband claimed her for the next dance. A happy married pair, their obvious joy in each other after 5 wedded years, was the subject of amused comment and mild jokes among their friends. The everlasting lovers, they were dubbed, and the name suited them as perfectly as they suited each other. What's wrong, Julie, old girl? Asked Jim after a few minutes' baffled scrutiny. Tired? Nothing, nothing. I just feel small, so futile in this crush. Sort of trapped, you know. Why do the Arnolds have so many people do their things? Quickly regretting her display of irritation, she added, It's wonderful, though, the people, the music, the color, and these lovely rooms, like a princess's ball in a fairy tale. Yes, great, he agreed. Lots of strangers here, too. Most of them distinguished people from town. It's a tall, browned man with Myra who looks like, well, like an Indian chief. She laughed a little at her own pleasantry, just to show Jim that there was nothing troubling her. Doesn't he, though? Sort of self-sufficient and superior and a bit indifferent, as if he owned us all and despised the whole tribe of us. I guess you can't blame him much. He probably thinks we're a soft, lazy, self-pampering lot. He's Ralph Tyler, an explorer, just back from some godforsaken place on the edge of nowhere. Been head of some expedition lost somewhere in Asia for years, given up for dead. Discovered a buried city or something. Great contribution to civilization and all that, you know. They say he brought back some emeralds worth a king's ransom. Do you know him, Jim? Yes, knew him years ago in college. Didn't think he'd remember me after such a long time and all those thrilling adventures. But he did. Honestly, you could have knocked me over with a feather when he came over to me and put his hand down and said, Hello there, Jim Romley. Nice, wasn't it? Jim's handsome face aglowed. He was undoubtedly flattered by the great man's remembrance. He went on enthusiastically. I'm going to have to put him to have him out to the house, Julie. That is, if I can get him. Small hand-picked dinner party, what say? She shivered again. Cold? No, not cold. Just someone walking over my grave. She laughed, amused at the double duty of the superstition in one evening, and glad, too, that Jim had not noticed that his question had passed unanswered. Dance followed dance. She wasn't being a success tonight. She knew it, but somehow she couldn't make small talk. Her thoughts kept wandering to that tall, browned man who had just come back from the world's end. One or two of her partners, after trying in vain to draw her out, looked at her quizzically, wondering if the impossible had happened. Had Julia and old Jim quarreled? At last she escaped to a small deserted room on an upper floor where she could be alone to think. She groped about in her mind for some way to avoid that dinner party. It spelled disaster. She must find some way to keep Ralph Tyler from finding out that she was the wife of his old schoolmate. But if he were going to be here for any length of time, and Jim seemed to think that he would, she would have to meet him. Perhaps she could go away. No, she dared not. Anything might happen. Better to be on hand to ward off the blow when it fell. She sighed, suddenly weary and beaten. It was hopeless. And she had been so happy. Just a faint shadow of uneasiness at first, which had gradually faded as the years slipped away. She sat for a long time in deep thought. Her face settled into determined lines. She made up her mind. She would ask, plead if necessary, for his silence. It was the only way. It would be hard, humiliating even, but it must be done if she were to continue to be happy in Jim's love. She couldn't bear to look ahead to years without him. She crossed the room and wrote a note to Ralph Tyler, asking him to meet her in the summer house in one of the gardens. She hesitated a moment over the signature, finally writing, Julia Hammond, in order to prepare him a little for the meeting. After she had given the note into the hand of a servant for delivery to Mr. Tyler, the man with Mrs. Redmond, she experienced a slight feeling of relief. At least I can try, she thought as she made her way to the summer house to wait. Surely if I tell him about myself and Jim, he'll be merciful. The man looked curiously at the woman sitting so motionless in the summer house in the rock garden. Even in the darkness, she felt his gaze upon her, though she lacked the courage to raise her eyes to look at him. She waited expectantly for him to speak. After what seemed hours, but was, she knew, only seconds, she understood that he was waiting for her to break the silence. So she began to speak in a low, hesitating voice. I suppose you think it strange, this request of mine to meet me here alone. But I had to see you, to talk to you. I wanted to tell you about my marriage to Jim Rombley. You know him? Yes, I know him. Well, she went on eagerly now. You see, we're so happy. Jim's so splendid, and I've tried to be such a good wife. And I thought the eager voice trailed off on a note of entreaty. Yes, you thought, prompted the man in a noncommittal tone. Well, you see, I thought that if you knew how happy we were and how much I love him, and that since you know Jim, that you, she stopped. She couldn't go on. She simply couldn't, but she must. There he stood like a long, menacing shadow between her and the future. She began again, this time with insinuating flattery. You have so much yourself now, honor, fame, and money, and you've done such splendid things. You've suffered, too, how you must have suffered. Oh, I'm glad of your success. You deserve it. You're a hero, a great man. A little thing like that can't matter to you now, and it means everything to me, everything. Please spare me my little happiness. Please be kind. But I don't understand. The man's voice was puzzled. How kind? What is it you're asking? Reading masked denial in the question, Julia began to sob softly. Don't tell Jim. Please don't tell Jim. I'll do anything to keep him from knowing anything. But aren't you making a mistake? Mistake? She laughed bitterly. I see you think I should have told him. You think that even now I should tell him that I was your mistress once. You don't know Jim. He'd never forgive that. He wouldn't understand that when a girl has been sick and starving on the streets, anything can happen to her. That she's grateful for food and shelter at any price. You won't tell him, will you? But I'm sure, stammered the tall figure, fumbling for cigarettes. I'm sure you've made a mistake. I'm sorry. I've been trying to... Julia cut him off. She couldn't bear to hear him speak the refusing words. His voice seemed so grimly final. She knew it was useless, but she made a last desperate effort. I was so young, so foolish, and so hungry. But Jim wouldn't understand. She choked over the last words. He shook his head impatiently. It seemed to the agonized woman. Mrs. Romley, I've been trying to tell you that you've made a mistake. I'm sorry. However, I can assure you that your secret is safe with me. It will never be from my lips that Jim Romley hears. You have been or what you said you have been. Only the woman's sharply drawn, quivering breath indicated that she had heard. A match blazed for a moment as he lighted his cigarette with shaking hands. Julia's frightened eyes picked out his face in the flickering light. She uttered a faint, dismayed cry. She had told the wrong man. That was Nella Larson's The Wrong Man. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I'll be right back here at KTO 104.3 in Juneau. Please stay tuned. Hello again. This is Ms. G with Telling Tales here at KTO 104.3. I hope you enjoyed Nella Larson's story, The Wrong Man. I definitely enjoyed reading that to you. I was looking for some more of Nella Larson's artistic endeavors, and she has done some poetry. So I wanted to read this one. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I wanted to read a poem by Ursula Le Guin. We unfortunately lost Miss Le Guin this year. We've enjoyed her poetry and her story so much that I found one I really like. It's called The Maenads. Somewhere I read that when they finally staggered off the mountain into some strange town, past drunk, hoarse, half-naked, blear-eyed, blood dried under broken nails and across young thighs, but still jeering and joking, still trying to dance, lurching and yelling, but falling dead asleep by the market stalls, sprawled helpless, flat out. Then, middle-aged women, respectable housewives, would come and stand night long in the agora, silent together, as ewes and cows in the night fields, guarding, watching them, as their mothers watched over them, and no man dared that fierce decorum. That is Ursula Le Guin's The Maenads. And if you're wondering what a maenad is, it's in Greek mythology, female followers of Dionysus, and significant members of Thyasis, the god's retinue. They're called the Raving Ones. If you think about that, you'll know what they are. So I did enjoy playing or reading that poetry for you. I have some other poetry I wanted to read or play for you. My tongue is taking over my thoughts here. But I wanted to play this for you because next week I have the good fortune of having some Wish Canadier poets here in the studio with me. And I wanted to get you prepared for that from one of our favorites, Mr. Bill Merck. So, here you go.
Iodine rain. Memories of cold nights when you'd kiss me warm. Warm nights when you kissed me warmer. The orchard of our senses, sweet as clover in July. Afternoons, we devoured each other like ripened fruit, licking love from our fingertips, no beginning, no end, sighing tired blessings over paths worn smooth into elegant pasture. In our country, there were mountains gold as summer wheat. Where and when we moved, footsteps ringing rhyme over gray stone, our shadows stretching further than history, eyes reflecting moonlight bright as clear night winter stars. Perhaps only those birds in the air, crying east, wings carving away at sunrise, perhaps only they could sense the weather turning, clouds blown gray against the horizon, that first iodine scent of rain, our curtain coming down, and the theater seats suddenly empty, a clock tower's once invisible face now showing hot and hideous as Mojave noon. Wind-confused grasses whipped flat, the path home lost. Caught up in the storm, my North Star in your hair, you'd left, taking with you that small whispering voice, a fading sound of horses shouldering away.
The title of this poem is Don't Want This Kind of Love to Disappear. I want to say that I love you how I love the glacier, respectfully and with deep appreciation. I love that the glacial blue color shows up best not on the sunny days, but when it's overcast, because you manage to continue showing up even when we're not on our best day, many days in a row. I want to say that I love you how I love the glacier, that there is no way to capture all of you in a picture or in a poem or in an experience, that you are something I can realistically enjoy daily, but when I stop to think about it, I cannot comprehend how damn lucky I am. How many people can see a glacier every day if they wanted to? How many people can come home and see your shoes by the door? I want to say that I love you how I love the glacier, the fresh, cold air and ice, mouth cold from melting water to the tongue or from kissing lips after they've been outside working in the rain all day. I'll say it, but with conditions. I love you how I love the glacier. But how to love something that disappears a little more every year. 150 feet gone, rock exposed, secret ice caves crushed, receded vision. One day I might not be able to see this anymore. And with this kind of love, it means not just preparing for a climate that's changing, but a future for love that is changing. If the only thing certain is change, what happens when your change disappears? No glacier, no more love. It should always be understood that when someone loves you like they love a glacier, they love your small, snowy things because they accumulate into this big mass that can erode obstacles into erratics and define particles into new land, that this love can grow and move slowly if you give it time and lower temperatures. Strange when someone is called cold, it means calling them distant or heartless or mean. But for a glacier or a person selective with their love, it means protective, it means resilience, and I don't want this kind of love to disappear. I love you how I love the glacier, with respect, a deep appreciation in this cold and slow way, this delicate and unknown way. Loving you means I take the risk that you could disappear on me someday, unable to be seen from the lake shore, shoes no longer at the door. But I'll try my best to keep it cool, reflect bright blue on the dark days, and live in the landscape you have already carved out of me while receding.
I hope you enjoyed that. That was, the last one was called Don't Want This Kind of Love to Disappear by Miss Ray Freelander, also of Rouge Canadier. And we had Iodine Rain by Bill Merck. So I've got 5 minutes left on the clock. How about I leave you with some music? And I hope you enjoy it. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTL 104.3 in Juneau. And I've enjoyed bringing you stories and poems tonight. Hopefully you enjoyed them as well. Until next time, be safe out there. Good night.